Paige Albiniak, editorial director at Promax, and this is the Daily Brief podcast. Today, I am super excited to talk to Laura McGuire. She is president of Made Music Studio, and Ida Mariam Davis, founder of Decolonized Design. And about a month ago, man-made music evolved to Made Music. And as part of that move, it also engaged in a new initiative with Ida, which she part of her organization, Decolonized Design, and they held several conversations that are now available to watch on Vimeo. And I will link those in the post that's going to go along with this pod. And then we're going to also talk about it in more detail today. So, hello, ladies. Thank you both so much for joining me.
Hi, Paige. Thank you.
It's my pleasure to have you. So, Lauren, let's start with you. And let's just sort of start at the beginning. And, you know, it's interesting because it's almost a year to the 1 year anniversary of George Floyd's death. But tell me what got Made Music's thought process going about this and changing from man-made music to made music.
Sure. So interestingly enough, it was a little bit before that we actually committed to the name change itself. And as you can, you know, all these discussions should be intersectional. You know, we talk about intersectional racism and the cross between white supremacy and the patriarchy and misogyny and all these topics. The name change, we were on the phone with two different groups of scientists from a government science agency. And both of those projects were led by female lead scientists. And there were two separate calls, and both of those teams took a moment to say, at one point or another, I just want to comment on how nice it is to be talking to three female creatives from man-made music. And I had those calls twice in a row from women who are in this industry that I think has, you know, been historically very male-heavy, women in their 50s who I think had really blazed a trail in science. And that to me was the moment to bring this back up to our founder, Joel Beckerman, who's always been really good about evolving and moving forward. And, you know, the name man-made music was created to be a homage to creation of music by humans, you know, versus machines. And also his name, Joel Beckerman, that doesn't mean that that's how people heard it or read it. And the misconception that might have been heard around the name when we thought about man-made music. So we started thinking there. And then George Floyd's death happened, and then Blackout Tuesday happened. Mm-hmm. And all of these conversations that we had been having about gender came together in this bigger opportunity and moment of like, oh, we need to transform a lot of things. We have a lot of work to do. The name is just one piece of something that we need to be digging a lot deeper in. And I think after Blackout Tuesday, which was a music industry initiative, we said, okay, well, that was fine, but now what? What's next? Nothing matters unless there's outcomes. And that was the beginning of our transformation.
And just to be clear, was Blackout Tuesday the day where people put black squares on Instagram?
Yep, exactly. And that had been started by black female leaders in the music industry, which was an interesting, like, kind of, that got lost in the thread of the story, I think, but that's where it started. So, you know, as it was a music industry initiative, we were one of the first to participate. And I think all the criticism of that is like, you know, okay, that's nice, but now what? Same sort of discussion. What are we doing about it? Changing the industry from the inside out.
And then did you guys ever receive negative feedback about your name being Mad Made Music? Or was that just something that as you were having conversations, you reflected upon it and realized maybe we don't want that to be our name anymore?
I'm going to say that we have an amazing staff at Made Music Studio. And I had heard from staff before that is this problematic when you'd be hiring people, it would be like, oh, do I really want to work at Man Made Music? I think that that's the only time I heard about it directly. And those were the conversations that we had is what does it mean to staff? Nobody from none of our clients ever noted as an issue, but I also don't know if anybody would say it to your face. You know what I mean? It might be one of those things that you might've been counted out at some point because of the name and it rubs someone the wrong way, but you never heard about it. And again, I think at the end of the day, it all came together as this moment of like, oh no, this is a bigger transformational opportunity that we're seeing here.
So as part of that evolution and conversation, you guys came up with a manifesto. So can you kind of summarize the manifesto for us and why you felt like that was something you needed to create?
Yes, I can. And, you know, this is going to lead nicely into our partnership with Decolonized Design, because it really the order of things was that we knew we needed an accountability partner from the beginning and a partner in how to address the gaps that we saw in our own hiring practices, in how we held standards that might be enforced in white supremacy. And at that point, we found IDA and Decolonized Design. So she really helped us develop that manifesto. For us, it was just a declaration of anti-racism and how we were going to hold anti-racism, what was going to be most critical to us moving forward. And then, you know, essentially numbers and quantitative data. How are we going to think about hiring? What percentage of musicians, composers, and writers on any given project should be from a marginalized group? How were we going to be thinking about speaking to our clients around issues where race or gender intersect with what they're trying to achieve in music and back-end inequality and royalties? So that's really, the statement was about getting those goals on paper and as such being accountable to those goals very publicly.
Ida, why don't you tell us about what Decolonized Design is and how you guys are working with Made Music Studios in this space?
Sure. And thank you again for having us. So Decolonized Design is a global consultancy leading a movement to create a more joyous and just world. And so while that is a very lofty and, you know, sort of values-driven mission statement, we work in a lot of different ways, from strategic advising through organizational transformation, changing how you think, act, and do, as well as programmatically, how do you meet your customers, audiences, clients, the communities that you work in, right? How do you really uphold the dignity of people in every interaction? So that's core of what we do. And when Lauren found us, she was ready to do the work. And this is one of our most precious and special partnerships because there was an organizational commitment. Lauren is great, but Lauren isn't the whole organization. And everyone really had this appetite to both learn and transform and also be a leader, take a stand, call people into a conversation. And so we've worked in a variety of contexts. I think of Made Music Studio more as our like partners and comrades in this work than the more client relationship. We are excited that the work that we do together is having an impact across the sort of ecosystem, the entertainment, if you will, like landscape. And Lauren can speak to more examples of this, but the work that we're doing is really exciting, and I'm sure we'll go into that.
Is Decolonized Design specifically focused in the world of design or entertainment marketing, or are there there specific areas that you guys target, or is it really a broad initiative that to impact any sort of business, which does seem huge to me?
We work across industries, public sector, philanthropy, corporate, and then within the corporate, right, like entertainment and all these other cuts, because our work is about really developing the leadership of organizations. We only want to work with, we're very selective, and we have a readiness criteria on who will take on as partners. For us, it's about how do you become the next Ben and Jerry's, or, you know, sort of organization and company that leads everyone, that Ben and Jerry's makes ice cream, right? They treat workers well, they massage their cows, they take a stand on really important issues. They are the kind of company that we work with companies to become, right? And so it is across sectors. If you were to look at, you know, our recent client, you might be confused to see, you know, kind of how it spans across sectors, but we are sort of agnostic to, if what you do impacts people, that's step one.
I'm going to ask a couple of nitty-gritty questions. Question one is, actually, let me ask Lauren, but Ida, feel free to jump in. And I feel like this term is thrown around a lot, but I would like to know what your specific definition is of when you say your manifesto is about anti-racism, what does that mean?
I think for us, it's anti-racism essentially. It begins with, I think the first line in our statement is that the people making decisions about what we hear in entertainment and media are overwhelmingly white. It talks about the fact that people of color and other marginalized groups are underrepresented and that we want to disrupt that. We want to dismantle that. We want to demand more, first with from ourselves and then from others as we commit to leading the industry on these issues. And that is true. It's also overwhelmingly male. you know, it's definitively there's a lot of marginalized groups who have historically been left out of entertainment and music. So that's how we held it. And essentially everything under it speaks to how we're going to get there. Ida may have a more much better definition of how she holds anti-racism. I can say that that's how I held it from my perspective and what our business was.
Okay, so I will ask you that, Ida, but also, can you talk a little bit about when you're looking for readiness criteria, what that entails?
Sure. And to go back, Lauren gave you the operational, what it looks like to be anti-racist. I would say sort of philosophically, anti-racist is someone who wants to eliminate racism. They don't want it here. The institution and all of its relics and remnants to be gone. And so there are steps to get there, which Lauren, I think, outlined. And your question is, what is part of the readiness criteria for?
Yes, when you have a client come to you or a partner in like Made Music Studios, when you're looking at somebody like that for readiness, what are you looking for?
So we're very, and Lauren can probably testify to this, we're very relational and we want to build relationships and commitments. And so what that means is if you come to us saying, so usually the first filter is inbound. If somebody comes and says, we want an unconscious bias or we want 3 implicit bias trainings and, you know, we want to advertise our partnership, that's a hard no, right? That's you filtered yourself out because one, you're looking for transactions, just some things to say you've done it. And two, we know both through research and lived experience, implicit bias does nothing for organizational culture. If anything, it helps dominant groups realize that they may have bias, but it actually is actively harmful to other groups. So I would say the first step is sort of how do you approach, what are you asking, what are you looking for in terms of a partnership? Mm-hmm. And then sort of once we get through, you know, we understand what's the motivation, what is your commitment to this journey? Because the reality is it's not a one and done. It is an ongoing conversation. Because we're dealing with 400 plus years of genocide with Native Americans, enslaved people. I mean, there's a lot of ways all of these things manifest, right? I would say the most defining question or readiness question has been, are you willing to exercise courage? Are you willing to take a stand? Because definitively, without question, you're going to have to be able to hold some tension. You're going to have to take a stand on something and demonstrate your commitment publicly to these values, to this process. And we have our sort of alternative. We actually don't use diversity, equity, and inclusion. We have a whole alternative. Are you willing to commit to that? Stand in the, I don't want to say aloneness, but in the kind of space of like, you're going to be leading other people. And when we look back at this, you would have taken the right stand, but in the moment, it's going to be uncomfortable. Are you willing to do that? And that's really where we lose a lot of folks.
I was going to say, do you find that people raise their hand, yes, I'm willing to do it, and then it comes down to it, and maybe they're not?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
That's enthusiastic, yes.
Lauren, when you were bringing this up to your staff, do you feel like everybody was sort of already on board? Because you said a lot of them had already brought to you this idea that maybe the name should be changed. Or was there any convincing or lobbying you needed to do, or how did everybody there react to these ideas?
No. And I, you know, I think that that's maybe just like everything else, there are certain ways that being at a small to medium sized company is really meaningful and helps you move very quickly. We had a staff who was all in from the beginning, who was actively involved in demonstrations as they were going on last March and April, who we're taking a stand on social media that we could see. And, you know, from the top down, from the founder down, there was this feeling of, if we do this right, it's not like we're a music studio and also we feel this way. It's, this is going to be like how we hold the DJJ focused company. And I'm sure we'll get to that. But what does anti-DEI mean? And Ida's philosophy there. Let's hold that as foundational. And know that we will better serve audiences if this is foundational. Our audiences, like our, if we're in entertainment and marketing, our audiences look like everyone. It's the whole of the United States. And we will better serve audiences if this is foundational, not an add-on, not a you know, a company who does music that also believes in this. It's like, let's build it from here. And everybody was on board with that. There were a lot of conversations about it, but I have seen, and you know, maybe it's just unique to the great company that I work for, but there was no fragility about this. There was just like, okay, let's do it, right? Let's figure out how to move this forward.
So let's talk a little bit about what Ida mentioned and also you mentioned, which is don't really use diversity, equity, and inclusion. And then you, Lauren, said anti-DEI, in fact. But Ida, what is, so explain that. What do you mean by that? And what terms do you prefer to use instead and why?
Diversity, equity, and inclusion in its current and historical form has been not only superficial, but actively harmful, particularly to Black, Indigenous, to marginalized people. And the reason is the default, when you think about being diverse, a diverse candidate or, you know, diverse in a group, what you're saying is that you're different than the dominant group, the white heteronormative group. Mm-hmm. When you say you want equity, you want to be equal to the dominant group. And when you say you want to be included or you want inclusion into these spaces, right, you're saying you want to be there. And we reject that. We don't believe that we should be measuring ourselves on a default or a dominant group. And rather than reform what we know has been harmful to Black and Indigenous and folks who, you know, have intersectional identity, who are disabled, who just are at the fringes of society. And really we demand and deserve better. So rather than kind of trying to tinkering, how do we make diversity, equity, inclusion better? We just thought, what would please our elders and ancestors and those who've come before us? What speaks to our collective humanity and has universal meaning? And so we actually created Belonging, Dignity, and Justice to sort of achieve all of those goals, right? To see the full humanity of those furthest at the margins, but also to think back and see how did our foremothers, forefathers do things? And that's seeing our full humanity for who we are. So belonging means as you are welcome, you belong, you are physically, emotionally, and psychologically safe. You don't have to change anything about yourself. Whereas, you know, inclusion can really be about assimilating to a group. When we talk about dignity, I think everybody understands that. It's that, you know, you're worthy of respect and honor. And whether you're the CEO or the janitor, what you do matters and you add value. And then, of course, justice just speaks to the fact that we're human, that we make mistakes. But if we don't have ways to keep people safe, to share that we will acknowledge harm, we will repair harm, that's the kind of, we believe, the ingredients to create a kind of work environment where people are reaching their full potential and they can deliver and do the best that they possibly can. But also, it's a culture of prosperity, right? It's fertile ground. It's a different kind of work environment than one that's motivated by checklists and standards, and it just feels different. And so we've created this alternative, and it's really been, I think, transformative for the organizations that subscribe to it.
Lauren, can you talk? I know that, so we went through some of this. You made this decision, you did the manifesto, you created the partnership with Decolonized Design, and then you guys had a series of conversations that, again, I will post. So can you talk about, so you've done those different things. What else have you done internally at Made Music Studios to move toward these changes?
You know, I think one of the places to start, which was very clear, was on hiring. You know, as a small company, hiring tended to come up fast. It was essentially everyone reach out to who you know, which means that you end up with a lot of people from NYU. Like, never mind every other kind of diversity. You end up with a fairly small group of people who have a very limited worldview and a specific point of view. And that was a complete from the ground up first step at rebuilding, because it was building our team. And it's really been fascinating to go through the process. So when it comes to hiring, it was about changing how we create job descriptions. So a lot of studying up on language that might be negative for marginalized people or different genders. You know, the stats that show that women are going to apply to jobs where they meet 90% of the criteria, where men are going to apply to jobs where they meet 60% of the criteria. So take out the criteria, you know, don't have that language there. Being very forward about our anti-racism statement and how we were going to hold those things, being very clear about the salary. Like salary on the job description, being clear about the benefits. When we went through the hiring process, there was one person who was in charge and they pulled off names and education information. And college education is no longer a requirement for our positions. That's just a default that we've moved into. We're in the music business. There are so many people with varied backgrounds who have so much life experience that is exactly what we need. We don't need people to have necessarily gone to a four-year college. Knowing that if somebody had been arrested or served time in prison, that wasn't necessarily something that said, no, we're not going to hire you, especially understanding the inequities that come with our justice system for marginalized people. All of that, those descriptions got pulled off as resumes came through, and resumes were forwarded not only to a hiring manager, but to a collective group. So that there was this idea of like, okay, let's think about this together. And that way we're knocking out those individual implicit biases or relational things that may come into play in hiring. We also made a very different overt effort to post in a lot of different places, everyone from the New York Fine Arts Society to the historically Black colleges and universities to some of the local universities, making sure that we are really opening up the reaches, reaching actively. The stats were really interesting. For a similar job posted 2 years ago, we had, 20 resumes or so. We had over 100 resumes come in for that same position with this new hiring practice and policies. Immediately, it was really interesting, and it made it a very different process to find the right person for each job. We just had a much bigger pool to select from, and we were able to say, all right, what experience are we missing at Made Music with the group that we have that we can find in this new collective of folks that's moving forward? So that's been a very big initiative. Other than that, right from the back on the back end, we're thinking about, as we go out to writers, as we go out to musicians, we want to see at least 30% from marginalized groups who are typically outside of music. And again, the music community is very small, and it can end up being very, it can end up looking like one group of people. So ensuring that we were opening up, again, we're creating music that's supposed to be for all audiences. So how do we make sure that we have representation of writers and musicians that look like our audiences, that we are speaking to them? So those things have become requirements. Next up, we're looking at management, reviews, those processes that were built from, I think, a fairly old, very corporate way of holding power and power dynamics, and really just reevaluating it. Like, how do you center marginalized people in these experiences? And I think one of the things that I learned from Ida that I reference all the time in work and outside is this idea of the curb cut effect. That if you, the curb cut being the curbs in Ida, you can jump in if I get this wrong, but the curbs being, you know, the cuts in the curb that were built for people in wheelchairs or who might have been other able that needed that, and but how they help everyone, strollers, bikers, you know, people who hurt their knees, like everyone benefits from that. So if we center historically marginalized groups as we think about all of these power dynamics, I think we will end up with a better place of work and a better way of serving all of our clients and for all of our employees.
When you have 100 resumes come in, let's say, how do you know who the right person is? I mean, do you have certain criteria you're trying to meet, or is it sort of an intuitive feel as you meet all the different candidates, or how do you suss that out?
You know, I think that what we were looking for initially, when you have that number of resumes, there is sort of a speed thing, like, okay, let's look at this in batches and let's get to those, reward those who came first or consider those first. But it really was looking for experiences that we didn't currently have. Mm-hmm. So, we had a lot of degrees or graduates with a certain kind of experience from this sort of ad agency or with this sort of musical background. We don't need more of those. We have those people. So who came through that really is going to have a different point of view than what we currently have? Who has a background that we can't compare that to anybody who's at Made Music? I think it's a very human thing to, and what I've seen managing for a lot of years, to kind of hire yourself over and over and over. You know, you go through all the candidates and you hire yourself. And the way that we held this for all of our managers was, do not hire yourself. Hire somebody who has a very different point of view, background, learning experience, work experience than you currently have, because that's where we're going to get the most value.
How do you do that in light of your own blind spots? And then after you answer, I want to ask Ida the same question. How do you work with companies to help them get past that?
You know, I think it's interesting, the removing of the names and the college. I think that, you know, people could point to that as being sort of implicit bias or those sort of things. When you have the direction to not hire yourself, and I think the direction was literally that simple, I think it'd be the resumes and the people that you meet into a different framework and a lens where that's literally what you're looking for. Like, and can I say to my manager or the hiring committee or the committee that's going to be responsible to this, like, this person I think is very unique and we're going to bring two different points of view. I think the committee was another way to do that. So that idea of getting rid of personal biases or personal places where you may not be able to see the value that somebody brings to the table. We had these multiple people to weigh in and say, oh, you know, that's a good thought. So I think that was a really interesting dynamic. And those groups were cross-functional. You know, somebody in the content group may have a certain point of view about what somebody might bring to the table that somebody in the music group may not have been clear to them right away.
And Ida, how do you work with companies to sort of help them get through this process and improve on it so that they aren't hiring themselves?
Yes, it's a process and a conversation about moving beyond a deficit kind of framing of like, oh, well, they don't have this, but we'll take them in spite of, to an asset-based framing of like, this lived experience is valuable. And to survive and live in this neighborhood and to do these things, like, we recognize that it's to recalibrate and value things, I would argue appropriately, but like reevaluate things, like what is actually important. If it's important that someone in this role be entrepreneurial or autonomous or potentially someone who has taken care of their family, and is just, you know, while in some cases might seem, oh, they might be a liability, right? From a pure employer standpoint, another way to think about it is this person can manage a lot of things. And, you know, with the right conditions, they can create things that we would never imagine. And we know that there's obviously the Kerbstedt effect that Lauren beautifully shared, but there's also the fact that, like, we really are seeing culture made at the fringes of society, at the furthest, you know, margins, at those folks who are most marginalized. We're seeing Black, queer people really own the conversation on what it means to be having an intersectional identity or what oppression really looks like, right? Because they are uniquely positioned. And so really thinking about how do you reach the most amount of people and really thinking about the work of unlearning ourselves, what is valuable, what is it, and uplifting those who have, despite the harshest conditions, thrived and survived, like how do we value that appropriately? I also want to say, I value school and education. When we say take off like education, it's not that we're saying we don't value it. What we're saying is we value these other things too. It's kind of a both and.
But what I was going to say is I think also in a creative industry or creative company, it's even, well, I don't want to put a, anyway, it's valuable also to have these different experiences to provide different inspiration too, you know, because if you're all kind of coming from the same place, you kind of come out with the same result.
Yep, exactly. We're a music company.
Right.
Like, so you know, music want doesn't different things. Come from education necessarily, you know, like, you know, education is valuable, but education can look like a lot of things, especially in the music business.
When we talk about professionalism, it's coded language for a kind of assimilation, and professionalism can be, you know, vehicles for racism, misogyny, classism, all of those things. And so by saying we mean what we say, we don't want those things here, you have to do things differently.
So what I was going to ask about is, so along everything that you just talked about, Lauren, but then the other thing I always think about in these areas is, what are you guys doing, or how are you thinking about training and then also developing? So let's say you're going out to these different places, but there's also people in these communities that don't even have the opportunity, you know what I mean, to get into the funnel in the first place. So how are you guys thinking about that? How do you kind of come into communities and start to build opportunities for people so that they're even able to be considered for these kinds of positions?
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge question. And I think, right now, especially as the New York music community has been, overall in a place of struggling over the last year, there's so much that we have to sit down and think about what opportunity can we create in the music community to help drive those opportunities. And there's so many great organizations. I think everyone has heard of about Girls Who Code, and there's similar organizations for women in music and how to drive those educational programs. And I don't want to try to recreate these programs that people are creating and doing an amazing job at. It's about how do we figure out how to give those programs that already exist additional opportunity or resources that we can bring to the table. We have a studio in New York. We have the ear of some of the, Fortune 500 companies who want to support the arts. So how do we bring to these organizations that exist to give this opportunity, especially, to children and education? And that's always been a high passion point for us. How do we provide for that? And it's a huge question. I don't think that we've solved it yet. I can tell you that, we continue to support organizations like the Kauffman Center, which is New York City's public music school, which we has a fantastic program. But that is absolutely, as we all come back into the world and we're able to have people in the studio, how do we use these resources to move things forward? And it's something that we're very passionate about, but I'm not going to sit here and say that we've solved it yet. You
No.
know, it's about, yeah, how do we open up those doors and give people opportunity? And it's just, music's expensive, and it's always been, we've had this conversation even about before this time with interns, that interns who come from a place of privilege have the funding to have the really expensive equipment, the expensive machines. They can buy the programs. They can go home and take what they learned in the studio and be practicing on it. And they evolve very quickly. They have the opportunity, they have the passion, they invest time, but they also have the opportunity and the privilege to do so. Those, how do we take what we have, which is those programs, those equipment, and some of that funding, and provide it to the people who have all of the passion, but not the privilege?
Yeah. Do you want to weigh in on that? I know, what do you guys do in terms of working with companies on training, development, et cetera?
How do we work with organizations on trainings?
And also, kind of what Lauren was talking about with these different community groups that already exist that are also working on these issues.
Yeah, so our sort of general position on connecting with communities and learning are that they can't be one-off and that they are commitments and sort of journeys. And we personally, and this is probably semantics, but it's important to us, we don't do trainings. We do learning sessions. And Lauren and the team could testify, it's very experiential. The goal is to show you better than we can tell you and have let you have that sense of discovery. And then when you do the work with communities, hopefully that sort of change of heart manifests in building real relationships that are not charity-based, but solidarity-based. So charity being like, here's some money, here's this thing, I'm done. Solidarity is my well-being is tied to yours. And so I'm actually invested in you, community member, audience member, whomever, right? Like there's a little bit of a different dynamic.
Yeah, a lot different, I think. Yeah, it's kind of like, I don't know, knocking down a whole house and rebuilding from the foundation up, right? Yeah, I mean, you really have to get kind of get into people's psyches and really change cores of things that they think about that they didn't even know they think about. I mean, I know even just for myself and going through this past year that, and it's not the same as what you guys are doing, Lauren, where you're really putting active thought in it, but I think it's hard to have gone through this year without spending some time thinking about these issues and thinking about what your own biases are and thinking about, oh, here's all these things I never thought about and that I should have. So yeah, but it's certainly not a one-off kind of thing. One thing I wanted to ask you, Lauren, is so we talked a lot about sort of as you bring people up and what that looks like. Do you find that there's a way to project belonging, dignity, justice in the created product? Meaning, do you feel like Made Music Studios music is reflecting these values now, or is that too esoteric?
It's a really interesting question. That's the goal. Can I tell you that I think that this year we've been more creative than ever. I think we've worked together in a very different way. I think that having different voices at the table continues to drive how we change and evolve. I think that upcoming work is going to sound very different from work that we've done in the past. It's hard for me to say. Again, we decided that the foundation of everything was going to be BDJ, and the work has changed. How do I hold like the changes that each person has gone through this process versus like different writers, different musicians? It's really hard. It's abstract to say that. Do I think that at the end of the day, we will be able to better serve audiences? We're going to have more scale, more creative depth than we have in the past? Absolutely. But, you know, it does all come together at the end of the day. I think that it's about holding it right, treating everybody with this belonging, dignity, and respect as they walk in the door, and hoping that the creative work continues to speak that to the world, because that's how it was created, with that feeling. But it's just, it's really interesting with music, and you have very specific clients who are always going to also have like a point of view that you need to bring to that work. We're not a band, you know, we're not putting out our own music. It's through the lens. I think one of the things that's interesting is one of the best conversations we're having with brands is it used to be brand down, you know, brand down, here's the sound of our brand. And now as we talk to groups and brands that might have stores, it's community up. And you can see that in entertainment. Who's the community you're serving? Let's start with them. Let's center them in this discussion. And then how does your brand interact with that community? So that whole process and approach is very different. And I think it's going to equal a different creative product. And a lot of that, you know, came from the discussions with Decolonized Design and their idea of centering, you know, they held Centering Marginalized People. And a lot of that has evolved. And the work that we're doing together is about centering communities.
I want to ask you a question, and this is going to kind of, it's not a planned question. So if I stump you, don't worry about it. But, you know, this has been, as we know, a very difficult year, but I feel like you seem very focused on the positive and the optimistic. Is there anything that you've seen in the world of entertainment, the broad world of entertainment, that has sort of lifted your heart around these issues that you think that is a step forward, that is something I'm happy to see?
Yeah, I'm a mixed optimist pessimist, and I should have started by saying my background is in like community organizing and community work, so I've seen a lot of incredible things. People do incredible things. You're talking kind of like corporate organizations or like
even just an event you've seen in the community, or really anything that you just feel like this really is like signals something like in a move forward or people are really getting it or a change or anything like that?
Oh, yes. To my earlier point, was a community organizer, have a lot of connections with a lot of outspoken activists and elders who have said there's never been a moment like this where the conversation, where people are actually, you know, for instance, grappling with the fact that police have been brutal to Black people. Like, we know that. Now it's a fact where, you know, previously it was like more of a conversation. I think that the syndemic of COVID and structural racism happening at the same time forced people to watch and see what it was like to be marginalized, to be on the fringe. And I think that woke people up in different ways. We've seen organizations and companies dramatically, like Made Music Studios and others, who dramatically kind of changed what they do and how they do it to meet this moment. And something we tell clients frequently is like, are you planning 7-8 generations ahead? Because looking back, you want to be looked on kindly, right, in history. Are you doing those things now? And of course, they're uncomfortable. But we think of retail companies that are highlighting those people who are most marginalized. And I just want to be clear, representation has been a very popular conversation. The advertising in the agency world, representation is not enough. It's mildly performative, and it does matter. It's just not the end. Let's not, you know, so things like that, where people are now saying like, yes, it matters to have people who look like you or who look like different people. It matters. We're having conversations that I think we previously didn't have. And I think we're seeing certain companies who only sell one shoe versus a pair, acknowledging that some people are amputees and not everyone has 2 feet, right? And so even just showing that creates an awareness in a buyer and a consumer to say, wow, this company cares. They care about, maybe they don't sell a lot of those shoes. Maybe they don't sell any. We know Gen Zers and those who are coming care about those things. Communities are now also holding companies accountable. So it's this bottom-up movement that Lauren's talking about, but really, like, they recognize, like, the dollar has power. So we're seeing even communities say, we want to buy Black. We want, you know, we want you to represent us. And we will show you, if you don't cooperate, that this is important to us. And so messengers like Made Studios and other organizations are really, I think, over-delivering on the work that they're doing by saying, like, this is not just good for the bottom line, because I think it's, we need to move beyond the return on investment, but it is good for people, and that matters too. So we're seeing that conversation, and I'm very happy to see that.
Okay, so last question, and I'll start with Lauren, and then I'll go to Ida, which is, I think we've touched on this quite a bit, but you might want to elaborate on it some. In what other ways would you like to see the overall entertainment marketing community, music production community, and expand that out, work on these issues of belonging, dignity, and justice? What else do you think we all can be doing in this area?
I think that there's been a lot of conversations that people are able to join. And I think that that's partially because of the pandemic and the way that we all need to stage these conversations. But I've been very appreciative of all of the resource that has come out of these organizations that are like, we are going to put panelists who, like, I want to be hearing from Black voices. I want to be hearing from marginalized voices. I want to be listening to them and their direction on how we can improve the scenario. And I think that has happened and will continue to happen. And I support all of those efforts, and also giving, I know everybody needs to make money in these, but giving access to those conversations, I think, is really important. I would say that that's the number one thing, that we have so many amazing people who are from marginalized groups, and I want to be hearing from them. I want to be following their direction. I want to be following their lead. I want to be listening to what they hold as most critical and being held accountable by them. And I think that that's really one of the keys. One of the things that's been so, you know, nothing's great about the pandemic, but having access to these conversations because they're happening digitally has been really forward. I think that that would be the most critical thing and the most pointed thing that I would see. And after that, it's about improving your own organization. Like, we can't, you know, I think that there's a lot of, what can you do better? What can you, like, start on the inside. Let's all work on ourselves. Let's share that information. Let's be really forward about it. Let's say, like, here's where we failed. Here's where we're improving. And that way we can learn from each other and we can all move this forward as a group.
And what else would you add, Ida?
Yes, I think you can't pour from an empty glass, so definitely start internal before you start anywhere else. I would also say that sharing platforms, representation, that is the minimum. I think that there is a place for organizations to acknowledge what has happened historically, acknowledge what has happened, what is happening currently. I think for a lot of marginalized folks, we just jump to, like, okay, let's fix it. And they're a part of the repairing harm process, and restorative justice really calls us to name the harm, to repent, and, or, you know, like, acknowledge, show some kind of emotion about how things have been, and then take a, with, co-create with people, with those who are most affected, impacted, or marginalized, what are your demands? What would you like, right? How could this look different for you? Not how would you, you know, reform or mildly change what we've already created. Like, how would you create things? Really engage their imagination, their vision. To what Lauren said, people have ideas. We're not, there's no paucity of, you know, thoughts and ideas. I mean, these are our lived experiences, so we think about these things. How could things be better all the time? Authentically engaging. And when I say authentically, you know, when we really believe that someone's lived experience is expertise, you pay them. You like, engage them in a way that you would engage any other kind of professional. And so thinking procedurally, how do you not performatively, not virtue signalingly, but really thoughtfully engage someone as your partner and build new things together. That would be a very philosophical and big picture way the marketing community as a whole could improve.
All right. That's an excellent place to leave it. Give some people some things to think about. Consider the work perhaps that you might need to be doing. You guys both, thank you so much. I appreciate you guys joining me and everything that you're doing.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, it's been
thank you,
pleasure.
Paige.
Thank you. All right. And then hopefully I'll talk to you again soon and have a wonderful day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. You. Bye.
That's it for this episode of the Daily Brief podcast. If you have suggestions for conversations, please reach out to us on Facebook and LinkedIn at Promax Global or on Instagram and Twitter at Promax_Global. You can also email us at dailybrief@promax.org, and you can subscribe to the Daily Brief podcast on Apple Podcasts, where you can also rate and review us, or on Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, thanks for listening.